Schedule, the Brewers and White Sox are off while the Cubs host the Dodgers again in an afternoon game. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Mostly sunny skies this morning will give way to mostly cloudy skies this afternoon with a 40% chance of light rain developing late. Highs ranging from 60 near Lake Michigan to the upper 60s inland. South winds at 5 miles per hour shifting to the east this afternoon. Tonight, showers and storms will become more numerous, a low around 45. Another nice day for tomorrow, sunshine, a high of 62. The normal for this time of year, by the way, is 57. Then for Saturday, winter returns, cloudy and colder with rain and snow. And we are expecting a slushy accumulation. Saturday's high just 42. For Sunday, the rain moves out, leaving us with mostly sunny skies, but the cold temperatures remain. Sunday's high just 45. Right now, sunshine and 41. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. I'm David Cole, WGTD News.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very excited that we can spend most of the hour talking about a very intriguing play, a musical that is about to open at Carthage tomorrow night in Wartburg Auditorium. The musical is Flora the Red Menace. And I wouldn't be too surprised if that's a musical you have never heard of, outside of maybe publicity for Carthage's production, which is about to open. It is a musical with which I have scant acquaintance, although I certainly know the name of Candor and Ebb, also responsible for Cabaret and Chicago. This collaboration, Flora the Red Menace, actually came before either of those shows. It was the vehicle with which Liza Minnelli made her Broadway debut, and I think she won a Tony.
She did.
So this musical created at least a bit of a splash, but has certainly not resonated with the general public all that much. But Carthage is dusting it off. We should mention that it was revived on Broadway with some success back in the mid-80s. So it has had sort of a fitful presence on the cultural landscape, but is certainly not well-known like other shows are, and certainly not like Cabaret and Chicago, Candor and Ebb's two biggest hits. But it has also a very, very intriguing story, timely in a lot of different ways, and we're going to be talking about all of that and more today. First of all, with us in the studios is Neil Sharnick, who is the director of this production, and with him, two talented young women who are part of the cast, Molly Kemper, who is Flora, so the title character, and Cassidy Scorija, who is Comrade Charlotte. And we're really excited to have all three of you on the program. Welcome to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks. Thank you.
Good to have you here. Cassidy, remind me, when were you here? You've been on the morning show before, and I can't
I have. Most recently, I was here last year for Into the Woods.
I played the
Baker's Wife.
Okay.
So it's exciting to be back again. For my, you know, last show here at Carthage.
There you go. Right. Sniff, sniff. But that's the way it is. Everybody has a final show at Carthage, except Neil Sharnick, because
I just keep going.
That's right. He was a student at Carthage and now a treasured member of the theater faculty. So, Neil, maybe you can enlighten us, first of all, on what drew the theater department to select a musical that has, in a sense, such poor name recognition. And beyond that, has a name that you know might even people might
be
might
jarring
find
a little
right
bit.
Right or find a bit like unattractive in a sense, but but something drew you to this work, and what was it?
Yeah, well, I spent a long time trying to figure out which musical to direct this year, and collaborating with Jeremy Mossman, who's my music director, finally landed on Flora for a number of reasons. One, as you mentioned, this is a bit of an overlooked Candor and Ebb musical. It was their first collaboration, came just before Cabaret, which would make them household names, but Flora the Red Menace was not the hit that they were looking for in some ways. And to revive this Candor and Ebb show that people aren't familiar with, haven't had the opportunity to see, and has such great music and such interesting characters, I didn't want to miss this opportunity. It seemed like educational theater. Colleges need to be the ones to take risks sometimes, right? The commercial theater is risk averse, and even regional theater. You know, a lot of times the larger regional theaters, when they're doing a musical, it's because that's the show with the big name that's going to sell a lot of tickets. Flora the Red Menace right now isn't that, but I think, and I actually just told the cast at the end of our notes at the end of the day, like, I think this is the production that could save Flora if people will just come see it, because it's so charming and has so much heart that if a musical called Urinetown can be a success out there, speaking of title names, Flora the Red Menace can certainly find its audience. So just the opportunity to work with this Candor and Ebb piece that people don't know, that was exciting to me. Beyond it, the history, the revival in particular was framed as if this production were a project of the Federal Theater Project. The play is set in 1935, which is the year the Federal Theater Project began, and it was a really important time in theater history, and has always been of particular interest to me. When the play was reconstituted in the 80s, it took that as a launching point, and I think even drew inspiration from other particular famous Federal Theater Project shows. This production doesn't use a full orchestra, just a single onstage piano, which I think is referencing Cradle Will Rock, one of the most famous of the Federal Theater Project shows, a play that got the Federal Theater Project in trouble. They were already in trouble, but in more trouble for its pro-union advocacy and they were already under investigation by the House Un-American Activities Committee for communist activity within the Federal Theater Project. And I think David Thompson, who rewrote the book, saw an opportunity for sort of putting in conversation what was happening in theater history at the time with this show that is about communist activity in 1935 and one young woman who sort of gets caught up in the middle of it. So as a theater historian, there was a lot that was interesting and a lot that recommended the show to me. And then ultimately, I think the character of Flora is what sold me. I think there are a lot of wide-eyed optimists in music theater, and Flora falls in that category, certainly. Mm. Somebody who sees the best in everyone. The character of Flora, she runs an artist co-op, which is really just her finding people she thinks are interesting and giving them studio space, inviting them in, pay what you can. One of us will get a break one of these days and then we'll all be okay. So when she meets Harry, who is a communist, he sees her as sort of a proto-communist, right? It's the collective cause. There's not a lot of attention paid to money and property ownership and these sorts of things in Flora's studio. So he sees a kindred spirit in her, but I think we learn throughout that what drives her isn't ideology, isn't political really, it isn't party affiliation, it's that she really loves people, and she loves the things that make them unique and distinctive rather than all the same. So these sort of misfit artists who are just looking, you know, have come from wherever to New York to make a break for themselves, Flora loves them and wants to, you know, to help them out. And where Harry sees that as communist, we learn that it's maybe something really admirable and individual to Flora.
Right. And of course, it's so ironic because we tend to think of, and to some extent it's true, that communism, at least as it plays out in totalitarian states tends to be something in which it is not about individuality or artistic individual right. expression, or we don't see it through that lens at all. And so what Flores created is so at odds with what, in fact, the typical sort of idea of communism is.
Right,
and yet
absolutely.
It shares these other qualities. I love the complexity of that.
Right. And added to that, she lands a job at a department store as a fashion illustrator and is being pressured to change her individual style to conform with the corporate image, the corporate look. Right. So you see the pressures that she feels from the party and sort of maintaining party discipline as something that limits her ability to be wholly herself and freely Flora. And at the same time, from the corporate world, she's feeling that same pressure. So Kander and Ebb never make the things politically easy, right? There's something always unsettling and destabilizing and scary about the politics of a Kander and Ebb show. If you know Cabaret in Chicago, you know that we find ourselves laughing and cheering for things that maybe we later think we shouldn't. We find ourselves supporting villains and you know, and being swept away. There's a lot that they do that's really extraordinary in the way they force an audience member to interrogate their own politics, their own beliefs, their own ideals. And Flora is no exception. In some ways, it's softened a bit. I think as they become more fervent in some ways and stronger in that, they really find their voice, you know, in Cabaret. But so this musical feels like a strange mix of love story on one side and political agitprop on the other.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, we're talking today about the main stage musical that is about to open at Carthage, namely Kander and Ebb's Flora the Red Menace, a show that opened on Broadway in 1965 and was revived in the mid-80s, but a show that is not done nearly as often as their two biggest hits, Cabaret and Chicago. We have with us not only Neil Sharnick, the director of the production, but two members of the cast, two of Carthage's most gifted students, Molly Kempfer, who is playing the title role, and Cassidy Scorija, who is Comrade Charlotte. Mm-hmm. Just when you have a musical with someone named Comrade Charlotte, you have at least a whiff of what it's going to be about. But Molly, let's hear from you a little bit more about the character of Flora. Ahead of that, I suspect that until this was announced, I'm guessing you knew nothing about Flora the Red Menace.
Oh, yes. Neil announced it last year at the
Theater Forum.
Theater Forum, yes. And he was very excited about it. He was like, "We're doing the main stage musical Flora the Red Menace." And all of us were like, "Oh, okay, cool, sure.
Gotta go listen to that."
Great, yeah, on our to-do list. So I'd never heard of it. I knew who Kander and Ebb were, of course. Grew up with Chicago and Cabaret, that sort of thing. But, yeah, Flora the Red Menace has just kind of crept its way into my heart. I don't know. I really love it. Flora is just this really relatable character who is so lively, and she is so excited to do the most she can. So she ends up signing on to a lot of things that she can't possibly do all by herself, and so she seems a little flaky. But she's really determined to kind of get people where she thinks they need to be. And so, like, they talk about Flora having taken some guy around town, been like, "Hey, will you go on a date with this guy? Hey, will you go on a date with this guy?" Like, literally asking all of the women in this cafe. And just to match up who we later find out is Kenny, with Maggie for a dance marathon. And that's just, like, the kind of thing that Flora continually does.
So she's a mover and a shaker.
Yes, absolutely. At least she tries to be. Sometimes it doesn't always work out. But, yeah, she's just so lovable. I love
her.
Wow,
it sounds like it. I can just sense that from the way you're framing this conversation. And at what point did it become clear to you that Flora would be the character you would most like to play? I mean, or did you only really become excited about the character once you were in the midst of working on her?
Well, I'm not nearly as much of an optimist as Flora is. So I went into the audition process of, like, I'm not going to get my hopes up. I will work as hard as I can, but, like, I'll take whatever I can get sort of thing. And when I saw that I got Flora, I did get very excited. Because I didn't even think that that was a possibility. Once I read the script, I fell in love.
Mm.
It was great.
And it sounds like you get to sing some of the most popular songs from the score, too.
Yeah. Some of the two most or longest standing songs are Sing Happy and A Quiet Thing, along with One Good Break, which I don't get to sing. But those the two that I do have been really great. A Quiet Thing is one of those songs where it feels very, like just basically lovely at its, like, very shallow level. But the deeper you go, it just feels like it sums up a lot of what we discover throughout our life.
Hmm.
And just to add on to that, I was actually just talking with Professor Mossman about it a little bit yesterday, that this song has remained fairly popular because it sings and feels like a love song, you know, and she's talking about how when these great things happen, you don't hear drums in a band and all that. You think you're going to, but it's a quiet thing. But in the musical, this song is sung when she gets a job. It's the middle of the Great Depression. It's not when she just met a boy. Hmm. There's a lot of those songs, but this is she gets a job. She gets the job she wants. It's going to pay her more than she expected, right? And that's the thing that she's celebrating in that moment. And I think in some ways, as Jeremy Mossman said, musical theater has enough love. It has a lot of love songs. Like, this is actually more special than that. It's more distinct than that. It's about those happy moments, whatever they are, those that sneak up and surprise us, and how quiet they can be.
Hmm. And they have nothing to do with meeting a boy or
nothing
meeting a
at
girl.
All.
Yeah, good point. I like that. Cassidy Skorija, tell us who Comrade Charlotte is, although we can guess at least
yes.
a little bit about her from her name.
Comrade Charlotte is a force of nature. She is the antagonist of the show. She is kind of a leader in this communist, like, cell that, Flora's love interest, Harry Tukarian, is also a part of. And she is just this very powerful and also very manipulative woman who I think likes the spotlight of being this kind of superstar in the Communist Party. And then when Flora shows up, this kind of leadership role that she has, she feels threatened because it's, I think, a really interesting thing about Charlotte is that she's kind of the opposite of Flora, where Flora is this very lovely, very lovable, very affirming presence who kind of takes charge of the room with her love and her verve for life. Charlotte takes power through fear and intimidation, and it becomes this very authoritarian presence in the show. So it's been really interesting to play with like using your power to take charge of the room rather than drawing people to her. Charlotte forces people to her. Like, she forces you to get on board. She's pulling you in, whereas Flora is welcoming.
Yeah.
So it's really fun, I think, to play with these kind of contrasts. And when Flora and Charlotte do kind of go head to head, it's this very weird kind of battle that happens. Solely because Charlotte, I don't think she can function the same way Flora can. She doesn't have the same kind of warmth about her, which has also been really interesting for me. I've never played an antagonist before.
Mm.
So it's been really interesting to find the things I do love about Charlotte. And I think she totally is that person that you love to hate. This, like, villain who, like, she's horrible. And you're like, oh, gosh, I hate her so much. But you, like, can't. I don't know. I hope people can't wait to see her come back because she's just the worst, and it's wonderful.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess part of it is you want an enemy or an antagonist or a villain to be compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you want them to be a fascinating character, and you, I suppose, to some extent, you don't want them to be so repugnant that, that you know, you feel like you want to turn away. It's you want to be, in a sense, drawn to them, mm-hmm. albeit in a way that's not like being drawn to a character like Flora. Right. So do you think very much about the ways to do that, or is it kind of on the page? I mean, if Kander and Ebb crafted her in such a way that she is that.
I definitely, Kander and Ebb, the way they write is so brilliant, because every character in the show has all of these really interesting subtleties to explore. But I also we've, you know, added costumes this week. It's our dress week. So having this kind of design element also is super helpful to kind of step into this world. Charlotte is very dramatic, which I think helps kind of draw your eye. Mm. But I think being able to exist on stage and just be very grounded and be very powerful has been really, really exciting. I've definitely been drawing on a lot of my like theater education over my 4 years and kind of trying to focus on existing in a way that is very grounded and very powerful and not necessarily being accommodating to the people around me. Like my scene partner's like kind of waiting for people to move to me, which is maybe against like me as Cassidy, it's a little bit against what I typically want to do.
Yeah.
But kind of making it a point to be this very, like, very upright and very proud and very powerful presence on stage so that people are forced to kind of gravitate around me when I have the opportunity to be that. Yeah. And I think that that makes, because Flora is also like that in a different way, but she also is this very, like, powerful source of inspiration for the people around her. I think the fact that we're both able to do that makes all of our like moments together super interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Like, so Molly is smiling and nodding, so you must agree.
Oh, they've been really fun moments. It's especially because I love Cassidy so much. It's just it's really great. This is gonna sound weird. It's great having to hate her because like
It's not in real life. So
not at all. So
it's kind of fun.
It's so fun. Definitely acting.
Right.
Time.
Well, and it's real play acting. I mean, like you're playing dress up or playing cowboys and Indians or something. I mean, like it takes it to a very fundamental level when you are on stage doing something that's the complete opposite of, in a sense, what your relationship otherwise is.
I also think it's helpful to have a person that I know and care about and trust so that we can like explore and push, like push farther and like do a little bit more because there's no... I just trust Molly, like, unconditionally. So, like, it's super helpful to experiment and have, like, a scene partner that is you can rely on so that you can experiment a lot.
There's something Cassidy said I want to just touch on, too, talking about the power that they have to influence others, the way that Flora inspires and Charlotte and, to some extent, Harry sometimes goads and incites. You know, they have power over each other. And I think the choreography and direction, we've really tried to enhance that, play that up, that you'll see Flora has a number of numbers. In fact, it's unusual. She sometimes isn't the one dancing or moving. She just sits in the middle and sings, and the world moves around her, right? Mm. And in a similar way, Comrade Charlotte is able to get everyone moving, but more marching in lockstep. It's a different sort of feeling. There's nothing balletic. There's no dance, you know. And I think we see that Flora has that capacity. Actually, one of the first scenes is her speaking as valedictorian for her graduating class, and she does as she tries to inspire everyone. They do sort of fall into lockstep to march forward and face tomorrow. So we know that she could make that choice. And I think it's important because she then finds herself being pulled in two directions. One, to join the party and join what Charlotte and Harry are doing and are trying to do, getting people to unite and come together and stand strong and fight. Or continue as more of an artist and an inspiration and a friend and see what that can mean and can be. So she has this opportunity where we see her early on. Yes, she can get people to march together. That is something she can do, but that's not really who she is. And she has to make that choice. Is she going to use her powers for good or evil? Yeah. Like, what is she going to do? And she is a powerful character.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking about Candor and Ebb's musical Flora the Red Menace, which opens tomorrow night at Carthage College and runs for the next two weekends. Candor and Ebb are much better known for their musicals Cabaret and Chicago. Flora the Red Menace, which opened on Broadway in 1965, is not left nearly as deep an imprint on the American public as a whole, but from the sounds of it, it is a very, very special show indeed, and the opportunity to see it on stage is a rare treat, so that's why we're talking about it today. Neil Charnock, I wonder if you could enlighten us a little bit, although I suspect some of our listeners are pretty well acquainted with this, but the whole notion of communism being afoot in America during the 1930s, and you've already touched on the fact that in some of these federal theater projects, it was a very potent presence there, but of course, by no means limited to those sort of circles and arenas. I suspect that in studying this show and the backdrop of the story, you have a better acquaintance than a lot of us do about why communism was afoot in America in the way that it was back then.
Well, first of all, it's a period in which things were really hard for a lot of people. We're right in the thick of the Depression. And it feels that in a lot of ways, the system has failed. The system is the capitalist system. And it is a period where there are some really famous, prominent, we know their names, Rockefeller and Mellon and Carnegie. We know these millionaires who are easy to point at when you are out of work and say, well, clearly some people are getting really, really rich in this country. And there are a lot of people starving and looking for food in the garbage, right?
And many more people starving than getting rich.
Getting rich, exactly. So it's not hard to see, whatever your political affiliation, now the attraction of a system that not only is entirely about getting rid of the filthy rich and bringing about equality, but also has an answer for every question. That's something that comes up, right? That the communists have the answer for everything. There is always the party line. There is always, so it's an easy ideology to get behind, to get around, and that and it's a systematic ideology, the system that that whatever your question, whatever your dilemma, whatever your situation, communism has that answer. So one of the characters, older than all the rest, Flora asks at one point, hey, you were a communist once, weren't you? And she's taken aback, but ultimately says, how could I not have been a communist, right? You know, with the world as it was, you know, coming through World War I, you know, and then into the Depression, you know, everyone's looking for answers, and they've got answers. Right. So, there was a very visible presence, certainly in New York, certainly on May Day when they're all out marching. There was a very prominent communist presence. And while we can look back and be upset by and offended by the House Un-American Activities Committee and Senator Dyes and all of that in a lot of ways, it's not wrong that there were communist activity. There was communist activity in the Federal Theater Project and in other places, but the sort of fascist response of therefore shutting it down isn't any more attractive to us.
Interesting. You mentioned that the show, the book in particular, was rewritten, and that was at the time of the Broadway revival in 1987. Was it rewritten in dramatic fashion, and in particular what we were just talking about, is that element maybe brought to more prominence or not necessarily?
Well, I think the politics are all definitely there. The idea that the show is a production of the Federal Theater Project, that in some ways we're taking our audience back in time, is new. You know, Candor and Ebb were really enamored of the 30s in a lot of ways. Here it's the communists, Cabaret, it's the fascists, and their rise, the Nazis' rise in the 30s. So this is a period that's of interest to them. And So, but here we get to see New York City, you know, not Germany, and we get to see the other side of the political spectrum, right? The rise and influence of the Communist Party, which in some ways I think we see what Harry does, and we see in Flora an ideology that feels communalist, at least, if not actually communist, right? That there's this the ideal that's so attractive in communism is present in Flora. And yet we see what party discipline and strictly adhering to the party line, what that means and how that isn't who Flora is and what Flora is and the dangers. There's a song in the show called You Are You. That's what the title of the song
is.
Yes,
You Are You.
And for me, this was there. And the original version of the musical actually ended with this song. The new version, it's earlier. It's still late in the show, but it's not the last number. And I think that it's what Kander and Ebb wanted to leave us with, really an affirmation of individual identity, and that was, for them, the most important theme here, right? That whether it's the communists or the fascists, you don't let a party, you don't let a society mold you and constrict you and make you what they want you to be, right? Mm. It's an affirmation of being who you are. And I think it's really telling that they originally ended the show with that number. It shows up a little earlier, but still at a pivotal moment for Flora, where she has to decide what path she's going to take.
Right. So, Molly, the character of Flora is confronted with this choice then of whether or not to actually become a communist?
No. Oh. I mean, yes, sort of. But that's not like the big thing that's...
She does
kind
become
of,
a
communist. Yeah, she readily becomes a communist. And that's pretty early in the show, very soon after meeting Harry. I think Flora kind of gets Harry to fall in love with her and or at least be very attracted to her. And then the next time they see each other, he's like, join the Communist Party. I like you. And if this is going to happen, we got to make it official. Yeah. So that's very early in the show. It's later when she has the job. She's part of the Communist Party, and she's made all these friends in both her work, her studio, and within the party, that everything's just pulling her in separate directions, and with Charlotte just trying to make Flora's life the worst possible and trying to ruin everything. It comes to a boiling point of Flora has to choose between the Communist Party and Harry, and doing what Flora eventually considers as the right thing.
Mm, that is a conundrum. Wow, yeah. A painful one. And explain, Cassidy, how Comrade Charlotte enters the fray. I mean, why is she on the scene in the first place, and what exactly is her relationship with Flora that leads to this antagonism?
Right. So we see Charlotte about just after halfway through Act One. Flora has come to the Communist Party meeting, and Charlotte has kind of crafted this world where she gets to be a celebrity. It's kind of how I've been looking at it, where it's like she has this little place in the world where she can be the greatest thing that's ever happened, and she has the adoration of the people around her, or she thinks she does. Comrade Harry is just enamored with her power, not necessarily like in a romantic way, but is just like she has his attention, she has everybody's attention, and the first time she meets Flora, she sees Flora as a threat to that kind of world she's crafted for herself. Flora comes in. She's this, like, fresh face. She's Harry is already utterly enamored with her. And Charlotte sees that people are starting to gain interest and starting to be pulled in by her kind of lovely gravitational pull. And she's like, well, wait a second. No. Like, you're all supposed to pay attention to me. So she gets frustrated with – more than frustrated. She's like – she's ready. She wants to shut this down. She's like – wants to maintain the pull she has. But – as we see in much of musical theater and, you know, ideally life, love is always stronger. And so she, as much as she wants to use her anger and her power and her vitriol to, like, maintain her control of everything, Flora's just love for life and for people, it always seems to pull people away from her. Mm. So the more that she watches Flora steal her spotlight, the more I think she starts to push against her and wants to take her down. And at first it's kind of like this, well, I'm just going to, oh, well, her ideas are bad, so everyone pay attention to me. But then that doesn't work. So then she has to be crueler, and she has to take larger and larger steps to try and kind of take back what she believes is rightfully hers.
Wow. Yeah. That does set up a fascinating dynamic, and I can see how a lot of energy would spring from that. Wow.
Yeah.
Sounds like a very compelling story.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, everything's exacerbated by the fact that Flora shows up, steals the thunder, having just gotten this job, right? Everything is going just right for Flora. She's got the boy. She's got the party of that she's excited about, a new cause to champion. She's got a new job. And she walks to the meeting and is told, oh, they're not a union shop, right? And that upsets things right away, right? Flora has just gotten a great job, but as a communist, she needs to be advocating for organizing the workers and whatnot. So that immediately causes trouble back at work, and everything starts to crumble from that moment on. Mm.
This show, again, is Flora the Red Menace, and it is opening tomorrow night. And you've crafted this production along the lines of the revival, so your production as that revival sets the show is set in the mid-30s, and your production, in a sense, is set in the 30s as well.
Well, we certainly allowed it to shape how we design and stage. I mean, we talked with Andrew Hildner, who's an alum and our scenic designer for this show, talked about the Federal Theater Project and the aesthetic that dominated there and then in the 1930s. And so it definitely has the look and feel. There's a character, Willie, who has sort of a privileged narrator position throughout the play, who's one of the artists in Flora's studio, but who talks to the audience and says, yeah, we're going to take you back to 1935. It was a tough time. Let's sort of set the stage. Hopefully audiences will feel like they're getting a little taste of, you know, what a Federal Theater Project production may have looked and sounded like, actually, back in the 1930s. We tried to be fairly true to that aesthetic.
Very good. Well, I'm very, very intrigued and excited to see this. It opens tomorrow night. It runs for the next two weekends. What do people do if they want to explore tickets?
The easiest thing to do is to go to carthage.edu/tickets and order tickets online right away. Tickets can be bought at the box office in the David Stress Center throughout the day, or can be purchased through calling our box office at 262-551-6661. So there are plenty of options. Carthage.edu/tickets is the easiest, but there should be tickets available day of. If you want to just come out, please do.
Very good. And for Cassidy and Molly, you're a senior also?
Yep.
What a way to go out with a very special show at such a terrific vehicle for both of you. Mm-hmm. So congrats on that. Molly Kempfer is Flora, Cassidy Scorridge, a comrade Charlotte, and Neil Sharnick, the director of Carthage's production of Flora, the Red Menace. My thanks to all of you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Whoever's interested in helping me out.
For part two of today's morning show on WGTD, I'm replaying a portion of my interview with best-selling novelist Andrew Gross, talking about his book Button Man, a novel set in the garment industry of New York City between the years 1905 and 1935. a family saga featuring some very richly drawn characters set against the backdrop of a particularly turbulent period in New York City's history. And much of the story of Button Man springs from the real life of Andrew Gross's grandfather.
You know, between the years 1880 and 1910, over 20 million immigrants came to this country. And the book that I've written, Button Man, is the story of one of them. My grandfather was someone who never went, grew up on the streets of the Lower East Side, which we can talk about, was the most densely populated area in the world, including Calcutta, and riddled with crime and poverty. And he had to quit school at 12, like a lot of, you know, young Jews who would just come here. He never got past the fifth grade, went to work as an apprentice in a garment factory. And by the time he was 19, was running that factory and the entire business around it. At some point, he formed his own company and had to go head-to-head against the Jewish mob who had taken over the garment unions for their illicit gain. And even to the day he died, he would proudly lift his shirt and show the two stab wounds in his abdomen that were courtesy of Louis Lepke, who was the most feared bloody killer in New York at that point, and ultimately built up his fledgling company into an iconic national brand. Some of your readers, some of your listeners, pardon me, might remember a firm called Leslie Fay, but at some point it was on the New York Stock Exchange, so it grew into a big diversified company. And so he had one of these lives that started with nothing and ended up with quite a bit. And so I put this story against the backdrop of a 30-year sweeping tale. It is a thriller. I mean, I'm a thriller writer. I'm paid to write thrillers by St. Martin's and Minotaur. But it's also a boy to manhood story and a period piece that deals with two sort of interesting things that very few people write about. One is the formation of the garment business in New York, which people see today as this big sort of glossy fashion business. There were two ways out for Jews on the Lower East Side. One was the clothing business that had no barriers to entry, and the other was crime. And so this story really sort of builds on those two facets. I call it Great Expectations Meets the Godfather, because it is the story of a young boy like Pip, who grows into not quite a gentleman per se, but an adult and a successful one against this class struggle. And The Godfather, of course, because of its depiction of organized crime and its uniquely cultural aspect, you know, they're the Italian mob, and in my book, the Jewish mob.
I assume you knew your grandfather. I mean, I gathered that from the acknowledgement. I want to be sure that you tell our listeners about something that quite extraordinary that occurred when you visited the library of the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. And your words, they gave you an extraordinary gift that you were not expecting.
Yeah, I, you know, in doing research for this book, when I first decided to do it, I went to FIT, you know, which is, I don't know what your listeners know, but it's a big, prominent school devoted to the fashion and retail business in New York City. And, you know, has, I think, 10 or 12 buildings and on the campus. And I went to the head archivist there trying to get information about the early years of the business. And, you know, the first thing she did was hook me up on microfilm with old issues of Women's Wear Daily dating back to the 20s. And interestingly, I found my grandfather's name. He wouldn't have been more than 20 years old, but there he was popping up all over the place as kind of, you know, an important, we call them machers, and well, in Yiddish would be like, you know, an important person, even at that ridiculously young age. And then, you know, a bunch of old sort of dog-eared, you know, worn books that no one had ever taken out in decades. And then, as you say, she gave me something that I will never forget. And she told me many of the founding fathers of this industry gave their oral testimonies on tape for the permanent archives here. Would you like to hear your grandfather's? And that was how, 30 years after he died, I got to hear his voice all over again on 2.5 hours of tape, going over the stories that I knew, you know, growing up. I certainly had heard from him, you know, many, many times, but hearing it now in his own gravelly voice, you know, in his own sort of street-hewn way of talking, because he never had much education. Interestingly, before he died, his name was on the buildings in four college campuses. So, you know, he I guess, did his best to make up for a lack of education. But there I was listening to him as if he had never died, as if he had just gone away a few years, and now he was back. So it was a very emotional experience for me. I have to admit I sort of wept through a lot of it, and, you know, of course, have shared it prominently in the family, and even more so now have shared it in this book with everyone.
You call this his story with only a few embellishments, that his story, meaning your grandfather's story, with only a few embellishments. Can you give us a little clearer idea of just what the balance is here between, in a sense, fact and fiction, the historical record as you understand it, versus whatever had to be added to the story to leaven it, to give it the texture that was appropriate for this kind of a book?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, for your readers who might remember Doctorow's book Ragtime, where historical figures sort of, you know, laced, you know, seamlessly in with fictional figures, this book is very much like that. Prominent characters in this book are mobsters like Louis Lepke, who is the principal adversary, who the main character grew up with as a kid on the streets, and has this sort of really interesting respect hatred relationship with. They both respect each other because the main character Morris, based after my grandfather, stood up to him. So, I mean, you know, because my grandfather lived kind of a rich life, I didn't have to embellish too much. But I'm a thriller writer, and obviously, when you do that, you have to perhaps, you know, stretch the stories a little bit. The scenes are mine. I mean, I wasn't there. Nobody was really there. The scenes are all mine. It reads like a novel, but at the same time, many of the figures in the book are real. So we have, like I mentioned, Lepke. Dutch Schultz, the famous mobster, Jewish mobster, is a prominent figure in the book. Also is Thomas Dewey, who was the appointed special prosecutor, who was Javert-like in single-mindedly trying to put Lepke and Dutch Schultz away behind bars for good. He ended up running for governor and ended up running for president at some point. And you know, like I said, my grandfather's life was rich enough. He was attacked by the mob. He did stand up to the mob. So that, you know, as a novelist, I mean, of course, you're going to take some liberties with it. But the central truth is what it was like to be there at that time, and the history both of the garment business and the Jewish mob.
Andrew Gross is the author of the novel Button Man, published by Minotaur Books. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm very excited to welcome back into our studios Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College, to talk about this wide field of Democratic contenders for president, and in particular, how these various candidates are handling the crucial issue of climate change. On Monday, I'll be speaking with Cameron Swallow. She is the wife of President John Swallow at Carthage. And Cameron Swallow's many activities outside of the Carthage community include her work with a group called Better Angels, which seeks to reduce the intense polarization politically in our country right now, trying to enable people from across the political aisle to be able to communicate with each other better and understand each other better. And on Tuesday, Penny Farmer, whose a remarkable book, Dead in the Water, tells of her family's tireless pursuit over the course of 40 years